Up next from the Center for Social Innovation, Severin Borenstein, co-director of the Energy Institute at the Haas School of Business, discusses policy instruments that support the development of renewable energy sources. He spoke at the Climate Policy Instruments for the Real World conference, convened by the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford. On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation in the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation.
Morning. Frank asked me to talk about renewable energy incentives this morning, and particularly to highlight some research that I've done on solar PV. I want to start out by just reminding you that although people often talk about the energy policy challenge, there are actually three or four challenges that people often sort of meld together, and I think often to the detriment of good policy discussion. The economic impact, the microeconomic impact, which is the one that all the newspapers write articles about, that gasoline just costs too damn much. The macroeconomic impact, for which there probably is real policy arguments, that a country that is reliant on trade, on imports of a scarce and volatile priced fuel is likely to suffer more macroeconomic upheaval. The geopolitical issue of wealth transfers that is mostly, like the economic impact, an oil price issue, not an energy issue generally, because that's the area where the U.S. is a major importer. And then finally, the environmental impact. The coal industry is fond of pointing out that they have the solution to the energy challenge. They just define the energy challenge as the first two. And if you define it exclusively as the first two, burning a whole lot of coal is a solution. But, of course, if you take into account the environmental effects, until carbon sequestration becomes economic, it's pretty clearly not. So let me talk about, as an energy economist, leave this slide without pointing out that energy efficiency is the solution to everything that ails you. So the argument for government policy generally has to rely on some failure of the market. We live in a capitalist economy. We think markets generally drive incentives pretty well. But we also, if we aren't religious about markets, recognize that markets sometimes fail to generate the right incentives. The first two, macroeconomic volatility and geopolitics, are really oil issues. And I'm not really going to focus on oil today because I'm going to focus on electricity. And the U.S. doesn't really use oil for electricity and is not likely to anytime soon. And so while those are arguments for government intervention, and I think Chris Knittel will address some of them in the next talk, I'm going to set those aside. There is, of course, the environmental externalities, the market failure that's easy to understand, at least for most people, that if people don't take into account the fact that they're damaging the environment, they will overuse a resource. There's a more subtle argument, though widely recognized, that basic research, basic scientific knowledge will be underinvested in by a market economy without government intervention because there are huge spillovers that the investor can't capture. What are not market failures is the high price of oil and gasoline. In fact, when the price of gasoline goes up, that is reflecting a real scarcity in the market. I could give a different talk on what happened in 2008, but most economists recognize that that was not market manipulation by speculators, but was actually a supply and demand issue. Nor is it the failure of my favorite technology, whatever that is, to thrive. I often hear this when talking to business people, that the market's obviously failed because I can't get financing for my technology. There probably are mistakes that go on in the market. There certainly are. but every anecdote about it is not a market failure. And of course, that's what we rely on the market to get right most of the time. And whenever we talk about government policy, we have to ask the question, not just is there a market failure, but can the government do better at it? And that's an issue I'm going to return to. Pricing externalities is nearly always central to correcting market failures. If there is some failure in the market, the incentives are in some way incorrect, changing the prices is almost always a very valuable mechanism in getting to the right outcome. It is not the only tool. I'm not going to have time to talk about it, but certainly there can be very strong arguments for information intervention to let people understand the products better, for labeling, for setting standards in some cases. But as a first cut, trying to get the prices right is a way to maximize reliance on the market mechanism while still trying to correct for these market failures. Low-cost energy supply is a challenge politically. It's also a challenge to renewables. But the fact is that if you ignore environmental costs, although I get a letter probably once every week or two as director of the UC Energy Institute from somebody who has discovered a new source of energy that is going to solve all of our problems, these are often typed on manual typewriters, which is sort of a giveaway that they probably aren't going to really go that far with it. Despite the fact, fossil fuels are probably going to stay cheap for a long time, and I'm going to come back. In fact, I think they're very likely, if we make progress, to get very cheap if we actually start to move away from them. Renewables are going to get cheaper, but actually the technology for fossil fuel extraction is improving too. And this is a slide I wrote before fracking natural gas extraction changed the entire natural gas world in the last couple of years. But that's a great example of it. Technology is going to move forward. Extracting oil is going to get better. Converting coal to transportation fuels is going to get better. Certainly extracting natural gas is going to get better. And I've been on panels with fossil fuel executives from fossil fuel companies where they have said at various times, such as 2008, look, the market's already giving us a signal that we should move off of fossil fuels. So the market's working. And that just shows a basic misunderstanding. The market is never going to work for externalities by itself. That's why it's something that's excluded from the market pricing process. And so no matter what the price is, it's still not including that. If we don't measure the full costs and benefits, renewable energy is not likely to be in the money anytime soon. So to have a significant impact on the energy market, an alternative is going to have to be economic. It's also going to have to be scalable. And this is something that many of these letters I receive and other people who, it's very easy to get excited about a new technology, but of course the question is not can you make a few gallons in your backyard, but can you actually produce enough to change the energy market? And that is a challenge in two ways. First of all, the economics of scaling up any business operation are always uncertain. Secondly, if we actually do ever scale up these alternative energy, particularly if we think about compared to oil, but also to natural gas and coal, the price of fossil fuels is going to plummet. If you think about the long-run supply curve for oil, there is some oil out there that can cost $50 or $60 a barrel. But the vast majority of oil is $5, $10, $15 a barrel oil. Getting the last 20% of the oil out of the market may not be that hard because that stuff's pretty expensive. Getting the first 80% out of the market is going to be extremely tough because if we ever actually lower our consumption of oil worldwide, the price of oil is going to drop to the extraction cost of that first 80%. That means the price is going to go down to $15, $10 a barrel. And if you think that renewables are going to compete at that point without government intervention, you are even more optimistic than the letter writers. Well, maybe not. Equally optimistic. Let me talk for a minute about pricing greenhouse gases before I talk about the renewables directly. As Rob Staven said this morning, and I will just agree with, cap and trade, greenhouse gas taxes, they're both policies that can address greenhouse gases. I probably think there's even less difference between them in practice than Rob does, but most economists who think hard about this recognize that in practice, from an economic point of view, either one could be used. That's not the barrier. The barrier is getting either one of them actually put into use. However, people often confuse that argument with the idea that taxing brown energy, whether through cap and trade or actual taxes on greenhouse gases, is equivalent to subsidizing green energy, and it's not. And this is really critical in thinking about renewable energy policy. Subsidizing green energy rather than taxing brown will get the ratio of the prices or the returns to green versus brown power right, potentially, if you subsidize enough. But it gets the ratio of the price of energy versus everything else in the economy wrong. So to the extent that you're subsidizing green energy, you're making energy too cheap. Now, that's not just sort of people will generally substitute towards energy. It's also a tax on energy efficiency. It makes energy efficiency less economic. So when we talk about subsidizing green energy, which has become the lead policy in some areas, such as the feed-in tariffs that are becoming so popular, that is actually making energy cheap and making energy efficiency less economic. There is a subsidy to green energy that is common these days that is better than the standard subsidy, and that is a renewable portfolio standard or a renewable generation standard of some sort. And the key difference there is that when you buy renewable energy through those programs, they get paid for through your energy bill. And this is how we've been doing it for 20 or 30 years. And at least that has the advantages. It makes energy a little more expensive. If you write out the full model, you find out it doesn't make it enough more expensive till you all get all the way to 100% renewable. But it does at least add to the price of energy. What we are increasingly doing in the United States is moving away from that towards subsidies that are paid through the general fund, which means they're paid through taxes on wages, which is about the worst way we could devise the incentives. So when we start talking about subsidizing green energy through some sort of production tax credit, investment tax credit, the stimulus money is sort of a different discussion, a short-run stimulus, but these longer-run policies, they are just clearly inferior to a renewable portfolio standard or some sort of standard that generates the revenue to pay for that green energy through electricity bills. Once you recognize that, even if you are going to go to a green energy subsidy, it's very difficult, and I would argue extremely rare, to be able to make an argument that different, equally green forms of energy should be treated differently. So feed-in tariffs originally designed, and the renewable portfolio standard originally designed, had the idea that you set a benchmark and then you let all the renewables compete for it. Increasingly, of course, we're seeing lobbying for special treatment for individual technologies. So nobody I know these days who advocates for feed-in tariffs advocates for just an across-the-board green energy tariff, which is, by the way, what we had in California in the late 1990s, the beginning of deregulation. There was a 1.5-cent green energy subsidy for all green energy. They're advocating for technology-specific tariffs and particularly generally for very high feed-in tariffs for those technologies that are very expensive. And as one advocate for this put it, they said, you don't understand, wind doesn't need the subsidy to be economic, so we shouldn't be giving it to them. We, and I won't point out this person's technology, we do need the subsidy, so we should get a larger subsidy, which is, of course, equivalent to saying we should subsidize the least economic technologies. As I said, getting prices right isn't enough to solve environmental externalities entirely. Information failures are important. There are also failures in basic science research that I'm going to talk about in a minute. So people talk about failures in the market for development and deployment, and I'm going to discuss that, and I think there is generally overstated. And then people talk about offsetting subsidies for brown energy. And I think there is some merit to this, but I need to make two points. First of all, when we subsidize oil production in the United States, we are not lowering the price of oil, and we are not lowering the price of oil products. The amount of supply that comes forth from those subsidies is so small, it has no impact on the world price of oil, which is what drives the price of gasoline, something oil companies are fond of reminding you when the price is high, but then forget when they go to talk about subsidizing or allowing offshore drilling. So that's not actually helping, or that's not actually giving oil an advantage versus renewable fuels, because it's not lowering the price of oil. It is just handing money to oil producers, and you can, I think that's a very bad policy, but maybe some people think it's a good policy. But, and it may have employment effects and macroeconomic advantages, but what it is not doing is changing the balance between renewable energy and oil. Now, that's not as true with natural gas. And in fact, natural gas is not traded in a worldwide market. Some subsidies for natural gas could actually lower the price of natural gas in the U.S., though, to be honest, the people who make these claims almost never actually go that step. I've never seen anyone go that step and actually do the study. It says not just how much money are they getting, but how much is that showing up in a lower price of natural gas as opposed to just shareholder wealth for those industries. I do have to point out that if you talk about distributed generation, which I'm going to talk about more in a minute, then it's not the wholesale cost of these conventional energy sources, but the retail cost. And when you look at the retail price of natural gas and the retail price of electricity, those are so far above the true marginal cost of the, even including the environmental externalities, that it's really hard to say that subsidies are actually, for conventional fuels, are holding back distributed generation. The market price for electricity, your retail price, is in California double at least the true cost of generation. Natural gas, on average in the United States, the markup above marginal cost is about 50%. So there's already a big margin being created that's creating headroom for distributed generation. I'm going to spend a minute on this. I think most people recognize there's a failure in the market for basic scientific knowledge. In fact, U.S. government policy in many other areas recognizes this. This is why we have a National Institute of Health, a National Cancer Institute, National Science Foundation. These are all set up because basic science research can generate immense value, but in itself is very difficult to capture that value. The value is downstream. The people who do the invention, the knowledge breakthroughs, generally aren't the ones who follow through and don't want to be and don't have the comparative advantage. The patent system works extremely poorly. It works poorly in most areas, but it works very poorly with basic science knowledge. That's the stuff we want to spread widely. Until very recently, we didn't have an equivalent of the National Institute of Health. The Department of Energy, if you look at their budget, almost none of it went towards research. Most of it went towards keeping track of nuclear fuels. That's changing to some extent in that there is now ARPA-E, which is a program that is trying to create a National Institute of Energy. And that makes a lot of sense. The argument generally, though, that comes up is that enough? And many entrepreneurs argue, no, it's not. We should have subsidies downstream, end-use subsidies, and we do have them. The California Solar Initiative is exactly that. The arguments, when you pin them down and try to sort out all of these other arguments, why should we have downstream subsidies, demand-pull subsidies, for renewable energy? One argument they make is learning by doing, or what's called the experience curve. There's no question there is learning by doing. Boeing recognizes that when they build planes, they actually get better at it as they build each plane. The marginal cost of building an additional plane goes down. This isn't amortizing the sunk cost of starting. It's the marginal cost. They just get smarter about it. That's true in every industry. But Boeing doesn't need a subsidy because they learn in producing planes, because they internalize that subsidy. They are able to fully appropriate the subsidy. Argument for public policy has to be, well, we can't fully appropriate the knowledge that we get through the learning by doing. It spills over to other companies. There is some argument for that. If you think about, for instance, putting solar panels on roofs, Solar installers get better at it. They figure out the optimal way to put the panels on the roof. And if they've been doing it for a little while, they're faster at it. They can look at a roof and more quickly figure out what's the best place to put the panels, how to get up there, how to secure them, et cetera. They can also argue persuasively that there are spillovers to that, because I hire a worker, he works for me for a while, he learns how to do this, and then he goes starts his own company. The question is, that's the right argument. If you want to argue for downstream subsidies for solar PV, that's the argument you should be making. The question is, how large is that? Unfortunately, the data really don't speak to that, and I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. People also talk about economies of scale. As firms get bigger, their costs will go down. That's absolutely true. Those are completely appropriable. That's true in every industry, and we don't subsidize every industry to get large. Industries get large because they make an investment, and when they make that investment, they grow and their costs go down, and they get to appropriate that. There are also network arguments, and I'm not going to spend any time on this. There really isn't much evidence that this is an issue, particularly in solar PV or in distributed generation. The empirical work really hasn't sorted out these non-appropriable learning by doing benefits from all the other things that go on, including exogenous technological change. In fact, they often, and I will show you in a moment, a graph that shows costs go down. Well, of course costs go down. Firms learned more about how to install it, but so did the technology also got better over time. If you really want to make an argument for public policy intervention, it has to be based on some failure. The failure that you could make an argument for is this spillover from inappropriable technology, or learning by doing. And the question is, are those spillovers any bigger here? And then you hear this argument about, well, even if it's not learning by doing, there's just this financial market failure. We can't get financing. The valley of death. The thing to remember about the valley of death is that it's called that because lots of bad ideas die in the valley of death, because they should die. The question is, are there an unusual number of good ideas die in the valley of death that shouldn't die because the financial markets are not perfect? And everyone recognizes that. They make mistakes. They don't invest in things that are winners, and they often do invest in things that are losers. The question is there really some plausible argument that the government can do a better job at that? And I think that that's a tough argument to make. The argument that comes out when I speak to VCs and entrepreneurs often is that the problem is regulation. And there's no question this is a difference of this industry. If you look at the dot-com boom, this is an entire industry built on regulation. A bet on renewable energy is not just a bet on technology. It is a bet on future government regulation. And there's a lot of uncertainty about that. And entrepreneurs complain about that uncertainty, and they should. But we cannot provide an environment where there's no uncertainty about regulation. And we shouldn't, because we're constantly learning more about this externality. And so the best the government can do is say, we're not going to have any undue uncertainty. We're going to make this a business environmental factor, like many other you face, that will evolve over time. And we're going to try not to be too political about it. That, I think, is a realistic thing to ask for. But this idea that the government needs to just give us certainty in regulation for the next decade is not only unrealistic, I think it's just not the right public policy. So let me talk for a minute, since I think I have 6 or 7 minutes, about the full market value of solar PV. So this is, Frank asked me to talk about this paper. I wrote it in 2008, and costs have changed. Costs have not changed as much as one would have hoped. You've probably all heard a lot about the cost of solar PV panels coming down, and they have. On the other hand, if you go to the California Solar Initiative database and look at the installations that are getting subsidized today, they no longer cost $8 a watt, but they still cost about $7 a watt, actually north of $7 a watt. In the rest of the U.S., costs have come down a bit more. If you do the levelized cost of power from solar PV panels with a reasonable depreciation of the output, with a reasonable cost of replacing inverters, et cetera, in the rest of the U.S., it probably comes out to about 30 cents a kilowatt hour. And these are really good installations. These are south-facing installations, or southwest if you want to actually value the timing of the production, unshaded, not too hot, really sunny locations. In the California, it probably looks more like 32, 33 cents a kilowatt hour these days. It's a whole lot more than wind. It's a whole lot more than solar thermal still. It's a whole lot more than utility scale solar PV. The cheap panels have had a much bigger impact on utility scale solar PV than they have on distributed generation. Some important things you have to adjust for when you talk about that. In this paper, I look at the timing and location of power production. There's a big issue in solar PV that the producers point out, that it produces at the right time. It doesn't quite produce at the right time, it turns out, but it produces a pretty good time. And that's more valuable power when it produces more at peak. Some advocates say, well, then we should just compare it to a peaker plant. That's just really wrong, because it produces a lot of power off peak as well. And so when you do that adjustment, it turns out you have to upvalue the power from solar PV by about 20%. It would be more than that if we actually ran a really tight grid where we didn't have massive excess capacity. Maybe someday we'll do that. We're not going to do that anytime soon. If you did that, it would probably be a 40 or 50% premium. It would still put solar PV at the distributed level way out of the money. There are arguments about location of power production, the fact that it's inside the load constraints. It's true. California, like every other state, doesn't actually incentivize production inside the load pockets. It just incentivizes production, period, installation, everywhere. And if you look at a map of California's installation, there is no concentration of solar PV in the most valuable locations. Theoretically, there could be. In practice, we're not doing that. Intermittency is definitely an issue. I did not in the paper actually analyze that. It's interesting. It spills over very closely with the love of both mine and Frank's, which is real-time pricing of electricity, which would allow us to actually change prices and modulate demand in a way that could production follow the solar PV output. And, of course, the environmental externalities. What's interesting is when you get into the policies related to solar PV, or related to any renewable that's way out of the money, the advocates will often argue, well, you're not counting that we're saving the world. Well, I am, because wind power is saving the world and central station solar PV is saving the world too. So it's not that you have to make the argument, which you also have to do, against fossil fuels by pricing in a reasonable number on carbon, which in my opinion is $100 to $200 a ton. But even then, these things are out of the money. Or you have to compare it to other zero carbon sources and not just say that you're saving the world. Okay, then the argument lastly is made, well, there's learning by doing. Let me just skip ahead. I'm picking on Swanson here. This graph appears in any number of different publications. And it shows you that in 1979, panels were $32 a watt. This one goes out to 2005 or so, down to $3 a watt. And then since then, it's dropped quite a bit. In fact, it's probably dropped by nearly 50%. And this is the experience curve. In fact, it's labeled the experience curve. It's not the experience curve. It's the technological progress curve. It's the economies of scale curve. It's the experience curve. It's all those things combined. There is no question costs have come way down. This cannot be used to make the causal argument that if we put in more solar panels on rooftops, costs will continue to come down at that rate. Most of what happened here happened in the semiconductor industry. There were huge spillovers from technological progress in the semiconductor industry to this industry, and that is most of why solar panels got cheap. Some of that was due to the space program. But very little of it was likely due to installing a lot of rooftop solar panels. One way, and a project that I'm working on, and my graduate student Carla Peterman will soon have a paper on, that one could think about this is saying, well, if there's learning by doing, and particularly if we think it's at the state level, that's where we subsidize, then it should be that states that have put in a lot of solar PV are really good at it, relative to states or other countries that haven't put in much solar PV. When you do that cross-sectional analysis, there's actually very little evidence of learning by doing. Turns out, yes, California's put in way more solar PV than everyone else. California started controlling for the differences in labor costs and other factors. This is often argued to say that this graph that every time you double output, costs drop by 20%. The number is probably closer to 2% is actually a causal, can be linked as a causal effect of putting in more solar panels. And that's the, if you're going to justify this sort of development and deployment subsidy, that's where you have to do it. I think I'm out of time. We do need major technological breakthroughs. There is going to be a lot of money spent on trying to improve these technologies. Solar PV is coming closer to being in the money, but it's still actually three times the cost of fossil fuel. And in fact, even if you price greenhouse gases at $100 a ton, it's pretty far out of the money still. Okay, so I will wrap up on time, sort of. Every economist has to put this in a talk. It's just not true that it's going to be free to meet greenhouse gas goals. It's just very unlikely that we are going to develop such a great economy where we're going to become the center of all these new technologies that it's going to completely offset the cost of adjustment. But the studies that say this is going to be devastating to our economy just are off by orders of magnitude. There's really no evidence that the sort of adjustment we're talking about is a major adjustment in the U.S. economy. Fossil fuels are going to be cheap for a long while, and in fact, if we don't put a high price on greenhouse gases, are going to be the low-cost way of producing. We need realistic policy, but they really need to be grounded in thinking through what's the market failure we're trying to correct, what's a way to correct it that actually gets the incentives right. So Frank and I were part of a team during the California electricity crisis that started yelling in 98, 99 that this market had some real problems, the incentives were not set up correctly, and firms might have a strong incentive to withhold power and raise prices. The problem wasn't that prices were high then, as we kept getting told. Look, what are you talking about? The problem was that if you thought carefully, if you stress tested the model, you could figure out what incentives we're setting up and whether those are really going to get people to do what we want. In the last session, we heard about offsets and the incentives that they set up. The contribution that economics and economic research can really make is following those incentives and figuring out how are entrepreneurs likely to respond when we put in this sort of subsidy versus that sort of subsidy, and which are likely to get us to actually correct the failures that we see in this market. So success has to be judged ultimately in reducing greenhouse gases. Another common problem I run into in these discussions is people, for instance, will tell you that feed-in tariffs were a great success in Germany because they installed a lot of solar PV. Well, that's not a success. That's a great expenditure of money. And they were successful in installing a lot of solar PV. They were not successful in reducing their greenhouse gas footprint. As a maker, possibly represented at this conference, told me when I looked at their study of their German installation and said, you're getting like 12% capacity utilization there. And they said, well, yeah, Germany's a stupid place to put in solar, but look, we could predict it really accurately. So that wasn't the goal there, and we need to keep our eye on the goal that that we really are trying to reduce greenhouse gases, not build a particular technology. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm going to throw a few bombs. I'm going to throw microeconomic bombs at macroeconomic analyses. So we're staying within economics. I want to suggest that market failure in energy markets is normal, massive, structural, and understandable. It's not the result of a conspiracy or manipulation. It's just the reality. And as a consequence of our inability to understand how big market failure is, we are spending 95% of our intellectual energy worrying about the problem of cost, when actually, I'm going to argue that's 10 to 20% of the problem. It's not none of the problem. And to start out, I want to show the scale of what we have to do. That graph represents the current sources of raw energy for the American economy. And if we are going to achieve what the climate scientists have told us we must achieve by 2030 in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions, we must displace virtually all of that blue thing which represents coal, and virtually most of, not quite as much of, but virtually a solid majority of that orange thing which represents oil. That's what we've got to replace. Now, we can replace it with efficiency, and we should replace a lot of it with efficiency. We can replace it with renewables, and we should replace a lot of it with renewables. And we can replace it with lower carbon fossil fuels, and we ought to do some of that too. I want to point out why I think cost is not the primary driver of the fact that this is not happening. We talk a lot about grid parity for solar. Google has their, we're going to make renewables cheaper than coal. Both frames which suggest that the problem is the price of some form of electricity that doesn't come from fossil fuels. Well, for 1.5 billion people in the world, the grid is irrelevant. Grid parity isn't the measurement. The measurement is kerosene parity per lumen. They light their houses with kerosene. Depending on what you think the true social cost of capital is in a country like India or Africa, right now, today, solar lumens cost between a third and 20% of what kerosene lumens cost. If you could buy solar in a bottle, it would cost a third to 20% of what it costs to buy the equivalent amount of light with kerosene. That's not happening. It's not happening because solar electricity costs too much. It's happening for other reasons. Second example, if I live in a 100-year-old house in San Francisco, I've got a third of it. I just recently had it audited for its energy efficiency. It's terrible. Rationally speaking, I should spend right now $25,000 upgrading my house. At the moment I had the audit, I had a way to do it. I was going to get a PACE bond. By the time I finished the audit, there were no more PACE bonds. It would be rational for me to add that $25,000 to my mortgage. I would save money every month, and I'd have a much more valuable house. I get a reasonable salary. I'm a good credit risk. I'm a sophisticated guy. I can't get the money. I can't get the money. That's not because energy efficiency doesn't pay for itself. It's because of market failure. Third example, and I don't want to spend too much time on distributed rooftop solar, but I want to point out that a great deal of energy that is consumed in this country is not consumed to do useful work. It is consumed as a form of consumption, display. There are lots of people who would like to put solar on their houses. It may not make economic sense ever, but they'd like to do it. But in most states, they can't, because they can't sell the surplus power that they would generate at peak times back into the grid. I have a friend in Piedmont who actually has the largest single home solar array I've ever seen. He's highly irritated because when he built it 2 years ago, he couldn't make it bigger because he would have violated the rules. But he's even more irritated because he owns a warehouse in Emeryville, and he understands that the economically rational thing would have been to put solar on his whole warehouse and take care of the electricity bills of he and his four favorite friends. And he couldn't do that. So there are lots and lots of barriers to the deployment of these technologies that don't have to do with their cost. Now, why is this? Why, and I'm not the only person who says that energy markets don't work. Jeffrey Immelt says it all the time. Why don't they work? I think the answer is quite simple. We designed energy markets largely in the 1920s for the circumstances of the 1920s. Fuel was abundant, information was scarce, pollution was free. In electricity markets, the challenge was you had a commodity, electrons, which by their nature were extraordinarily volatile in price. They can't be stored, and certainly in the 1920s they couldn't be stored. Demand skyrockets and is highly volatile daily, seasonally, and annually. Most of the sources cannot easily be turned on or off. Most of the sources are not easily dispatchable. So what we did to solve that problem in the 1920s was we created a monopoly for electric power producers. With a guaranteed rate of return, we shifted the entire cost of volatility from producers to consumers, but we gave consumers a very high but not very volatile price. That was a good solution in the 1920s. But it's a solution that is getting in the way of decarbonizing the electricity sector. Let me use an example from transportation. I just want to give you a little thought exercise. Imagine that when you bought a car, the dealer had to give you not only the car, but a coupon good for the gasoline the car would use for the first 50,000 miles. Imagine that we took the operating cost of the first 50,000 miles of driving a car and we made it part of the purchase cost of the car. Three things would happen. One, the actual total cost of driving would go down for the economy as a whole because General Motors could sign long-term contracts to keep gasoline prices down better than you can as an individual person. Second, people would buy smaller cars because they would recognize at the moment they bought the cost of operating them. And third, for whatever car you bought, you would invest more in fuel efficiency technology on that size vehicle. So we would very rapidly move away from an SUV fleet that doesn't optimize, even for its size, fuel consumption towards a much smaller, more fuel-efficient fleet. Not by changing the price of anything, but simply by changing the market structure, where the signals are felt, who pays them, and when they pay them. So what I want to suggest is that we need to fundamentally redesign energy markets, and that we need to redesign them to solve two problems. First problem is carbon lock-in. Because we have been heavily reliant on high-carbon fossil fuels for so long, markets are locked into that, and we need to figure out ways to pay as a generation. Society needs to pay for undoing that lock-in, or we're sticking future generations with the consequences of climate change. The second thing we need to do is to make sure that in doing so, we create a level and competitive, innovative energy market in which new technologies, appropriately priced, can gain market share without being obstructed by market failure. So we need to do those two things. There are four problems in the electricity sector there. There's cost, which is a problem, and we need to spend more money researching it. Grid compatibility, that's an issue. In the northeastern United States, every summer, about $8 billion of extra electricity bills are paid dispatching electricity from high-cost generating sites when there is actually electrons available from cheaper stuff because the grid isn't ready. Market access, the problem of not being able to sell what you make. And finance. And I'm going to close by saying I think finance is actually the single most important intervention. And I'm going to cite an example from the 1930s. In 1935, almost every American rural household had a telephone and almost none had electricity. That was because telephones were low capex and high opex and electricity was the reverse. Franklin Roosevelt did not invest in new energy technologies to electrify rural America. He provided cheap capital. By 1945, virtually every American rural household had electricity. Virtually none had telephones, because putting electricity in knocked out the low capex rural telephone systems, and they then had to be replaced with cheap government capital, and they were from 1945 to 1955. But we need to recognize that the most important question about the future of efficiency and renewables is this. They are intrinsically high capex, low opex. In fact, efficiency is negative opex. If we don't enable innovative technologies to get access to reasonably priced capital, they're not going to get market share as fast as they ought to. So I would urge us to think less about price and more about credit. Thank you.
I'll respond to Severin's paper on three fronts. The first one, economics. The second one, politics. And a few words about people and perceptions at the end. So, when I give talks on in other countries, in other parts of the U.S., on California's climate and energy policies. I usually start with a slide that has a little triangle on it, and I say if you want to reduce your greenhouse gas emissions from the energy sector, you can do any one of three things. You can use less, you can choose cleaner sources, or you can invest in R&D to generate more options. And the cap and trade pushes on all three of those corners, and that's one of its strengths as a policy instrument, is that it does that. But in addition, there are policies that then are targeted and push on each of those, each individual corner of the triangle, and those are different, whether it's subsidizing federal R&D or renewable portfolio standard programs or feed-in tariffs or energy efficiency programs. So in California, of course, we do all of the above. It's as if we went to a Chinese restaurant and instead of selecting a few items from the menu, we just said, well, we'd like one of everything. That's, I think, a good way to summarize the approach that we've taken here. And I think they're both sound economics that underlie that, but I think there's also an important element of political calculation that underlies it as well. So I'll come back to that latter point. So as I think I made sort of my first set of remarks made clear, I mean, I think that cap and trade is the foundational, cap and trade or carbon tax, either one. I agree with the remark that they're functionally equivalent from an economist's perspective. They're the foundational policy instruments that really put the right market signal in there that address the fundamental underlying externality of unpriced greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. The problem is, of course, that even if we were to enact cap and trade either at the state or regional level or at the national level or, for that matter, at the international level, we'll see a gradual phase-in in the cap and trade systems that have been proposed. You'd see a gradual phase-in of that price to carbon as the cap ratchets down over time. That's a reflection of a political calculation of what it takes to basically be able to get society to accept pricing in the CO2, and doesn't reflect what actually needs to be done in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to a level that's safe for the health of the planet, if you make an analogy between a health-based standard for conventional pollutants. So we know that we would kind of gradually, under any of the schemes that have been discussed, you'd see gradual increase in the price. And what that tells us is that the signal for investment in low-carbon energy sources will involve looking sort of out over a time horizon, trusting that that trajectory will actually materialize as anticipated, and that, you know, there's some encourage, and I think it also promotes sort of deferring those investments off into the future. Well, of course, we haven't even gotten such a program like that at all. Instead, we've ended up with no real movement at the federal level, and I think it will be, you know, a big question mark at the international level. And I think also increasingly a question mark at the regional level as we see the membership of the Western Climate Initiative gradually dwindle, and, you know, big question mark about what kind of leadership we'll see in this area and what focus we'll see on the cap and trade front with a new governor that we get next year. So instead of having a cap and trade program that's a foundation with other things built on top of it to address temporal issues or more sector-specific market failures, we may very well be left with just those policies without the sort of the rug or the foundation pulled out from under those policies. And in a sense, where that leaves us, if we don't address, again, that fundamental externality with a pervasive economy-wide price that goes across sectors, is that that really bounces us into what is effectively a realm of industrial policy. And if you think about the various wedge analyses that have been done, whether the Princeton one or the EPRI one or other ones, you know, what they really do is they say, like, okay, well, here are all the solutions that we know about today. Some of them are things that are commercial today. Others are technologies that are at, you know, very early stages, but in principle could be commercialized and could help reduce CO2 emissions. And, you know, most of these wedge analyses involve the same ingredients, but in different proportions. But what all of them really, you know, sort of point to is some sort of industrial policy that involve, in the absence of cap and trade, some sort of industrial policy that effectively involves sort of choosing to subsidize one or the other of those wedges or those sectors of the economy to varying degrees. And, you know, that certainly sends us off into, you know, from a strict microeconomic perspective, that definitely sends us off into the realm of the second best. And I think that's, you know, for the foreseeable future, that seems like where we're headed. Let's see. So I think that's, you know, that's, I think that's a good framework to think about the state we find ourselves in and how to think about RPS and some of the other projects that we're talking about, some of the other policies that we're looking at. Let me talk a little bit about what I thought was an interesting point that Severin made, that subsidizing green energy is in effect a tax on energy efficiency because it has the effect of changing relative prices. I mean, I thought that was a good observation. I would note, though, that that's a more useful observation if the only policy that you're looking at is subsidizing renewable energy. But we have a, you know, again, we have a whole suite of policies in California, and most federal legislation, energy legislation, has also looked at a suite of policies that involves both subsidies to renewable energy through one form or another, and subsidies to energy efficiency or other types of measures to provide financial incentives for energy efficiency. That's not to say that, well, I'll just leave it at that. So I think we can't look at the, you know, the RPS in isolation. We have to recognize that it's almost always packaged. Renewable incentives are almost always packaged with some sort of efficiency incentives as well, and that the way that they're structured really goes to the heart of the needs of the actors that have to make the decisions, whether it's the homeowner or the manufacturer of appliances or so on and so forth on the energy efficiency side versus the renewable energy developer or the homeowner who might install solar on the green energy side. Let me also make a comment about the California Solar Initiative. So the state, the program that we have in the state that has a declining series of subsidies for consumers to invest, either homeowners or businesses to invest in solar panels or solar PV. Just one point about that. Severin's right in that, yes, we haven't really seen very significant declines in the costs of these systems over time, and there are various factors, other factors besides the program that can contribute to it. But if you look back at the policy rationale for putting the CSI in place, it was really primarily to create an industry that could stand on its own without significant subsidies. And while the prices of the systems have declined a relatively small amount, the subsidies that are being paid out by the state have gone down by more than a factor of three. So the original subsidies were on the order of $250 a watt. We've stepped down a number of steps in that ramp down on subsidies and are down to about 65 cents. And so, of course, there's still a significant subsidy in the form of net metering, but those direct subsidies to people for installing solar systems are largely going away. And if people choose to do it, even though it's not economic, that's a different matter than if the state is supporting the industry or other ratepayers are supporting the industry. I see Frank standing up, so I'm going to just quickly touch on one, sort of the other two points I wanted to make. On the political side, again, now that we are really more sort of in the realm, well, even if we were choosing between cap and trade and command and control type programs, I think it's important to appreciate that, and history has borne this out, that it's simply easier. If you're going to address climate change, the thing that you can do are the things that you can get through the legislative process. And the things that you can get through the legislative process are things like renewable portfolio standards. We haven't gotten a 33% RPS through the legislative process in California yet, but we've already got a 20% RPS, and I think we'll see a 33% RPS. And I think the reason for that is that the results are tangible. The big fight lately has been about whether those tangible results in the form of new green energy facilities will be in California or somewhere else. I think it's very important, again, for the political sustainability of programs like this to recognize that labor is not on the side of arguing against green energy, but labor is on the side of arguing where those green energy investments should be. So the major players, I think, are all aligned, and our legislature are all aligned that we need to have this outcome. It's just a matter of how we're going to do it that's really the main thing that we're focusing on right now. So I'll close by saying that there's one thing that Severin kind of passed over, but I do think that really merits much, much more attention and, in fact, could be the subject of its own conference. And it's not a market failure per se, but the perceptual barriers that really prevent people from making the kinds of investments in energy efficiency or vehicle efficiency that they might make. There was a very interesting article in The Economist a couple of weeks ago now that reported on a study that was published at, it had been like a National Science Foundation publication or something like that, but basically show that the larger the end use, so air conditioning versus a light bulb, or the larger the savings from an energy efficiency measure, so tuning up your air conditioner versus changing out your light bulb for a compact fluorescent, the larger those impacts, the more people tend to underestimate them. So in other words, people really don't appreciate how much energy they use and how much they could save from some of the measures that make the biggest difference. This is why I think we need to invest in the smart meters throughout California and the educational programs that go with them so that people really understand the differences they can make. But I think there's other policy instruments we need to apply as well, because if we don't address that perceptual barrier, I think we're leaving a lot of tons on the table. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I'm even happy that you went as far as you did on that last point.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mike Seifried. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.